We are, and by the way, I've been, of course, recording the each week and putting them up on the internet. We have a kind of a spotty record with regard to the class because of the weather and that kind of thing. And then last week, I accidentally deleted the deal before getting it up, so I lost it completely. And as soon as I hit that button, I thought, wait, and it was too late. So not every class is up there, but most of them are, and we'll make sure that we get today's up as well. So perhaps it would be good for us to do just a very quick review in case someone misses it and does want to listen. Last week we began our discussion of Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and noted that there are basically two sections that is covered in our booklets. One has to do with the qualities of leadership, and the second, the unsolved mysteries of life, which we haven't gotten to. The first section, the six qualities of a great leader, the first three we discussed last week, that a great leader sees the big picture. That's a part of wisdom, the ability to lead, whether it be a leader in the home, in the church, at work, whatever the case. There has to be a vision there, a knowledge of which direction to go and what are the right decisions to make. And that is, I think, a byproduct of wisdom. Second point, great leaders understand that leading is relational, not positional. We emphasize, of course, the position of elders in the church because they have authority, the position of a father or husband in the home because of his authority, the position of an employer or a boss in the workplace because of their authority. But their authority does not make them effective, and that's the point that is being made here. So a person who is very successful in what he's doing is not pulling people along, but he is using his friendliness, his approachability, his ability to develop a relationship with those who he is leading to make it to where they're wanting to pull along with him. And there is a distinction. And so everyone, I'm sure you hear about the dictatorial boss at work and how nobody likes him and nobody wants to do for him. And it seems like the worse it gets, the more dictatorial he gets and hard in his approach. And it's just kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that that person's going to fail. He makes this point by alluding to, in the latter part of that first verse, the sternness of his face is changed. That wisdom changes the sternness of the face, and indicates again is the grimness is not there in a good leader. There is that friendliness, there is that approachability that is found when an individual is kind and friendly, and that's an important part of leadership. Again, you'll remember I objected to that just a little bit in that almost sounds a little bit, what's the word on the surface? Not superficial. Yeah, that's the term. But again, the demeanor is something that we cannot overemphasize as far as importance. You can have someone who is sober-minded and serious, and he may not be that big smiling salesman that you see others be and still be an effective leader. But the need to be approachable and loved by those that you're leading is something that's important. It's less personality and more effort, I think, in that regard. And then the third section is great leaders speak with discretion and the ability to know when to be quiet and to not speak and to keep a secret. That's especially important with regard to leadership. So those are the three that we discussed last week. Anybody have any questions or comments about any of those three before we get into new material? All right, then we get to the middle of page 38, and where we ended up is great leaders know the value of timing. And the text is verses 5 through 7. Would someone read verses 5 through 7 of Ecclesiastes 8 for me, please?
He who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every delight, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. If no one knows what will happen, who can tell him when it will happen?
Okay. How far was it? Chapter 8, verses 5 through 7. Okay. What's the version you're reading from?
Let's see.
Just curious.
New American Standard.
New American Standard, okay. Uh-huh. It's probably the one that Wilson Adams uses as well, because he uses that word procedure as well. You'll notice if you have a King James like I do, it says a wise man's heart, that's the latter part of verse 5. Wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment, time and procedure. And the word procedure, I think, is the more accurate with regard to that. In other words, it has to do not so much with a person's individual judgment or discernment, but rather the best way to go about with something, or what's the best way to handle a particular thing. And so one of the points that he makes here as a part of this is that a wise man will know when things should be done and other times when they should be postponed and not be done. Wisdom knows the difference about those kinds of things. And, there are some things that, some days that you need to and have to spend just putting out fires or handling the difficulties of life, and then later you'll make those further plans or accomplish those further actions. To ignore the immediate necessities, the idea, in fact, a New Testament reference to the ox in the ditch, and to not recognize that or remember that is something that is sometimes destructive, overlooking what needs to be handled now because of great plans that you have. And the second thing is the ability to handle those difficulties of life. And it says in the latter paragraph, or the latter last verse in the paragraph under letter D, that great leaders remain calm and steady through the storm. When Murphy's Law is upon you and everything is going wrong, the ability to handle those things and not be derailed is something that is indicative of good leadership. So they're maybe not one of the most applicable things with regard to spiritual matters, but nevertheless a legitimate point, I think, made. Letter E is the final one, which means, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So he's the one that messed up, because he says 6 qualities of a great leader, and there's only 5 of them. Is that right, or am I missing something? I see 5 points in his statement of 6. So we found a mistake in the book. 5 points. 5 qualities of a great leader, I guess. Unless he's trying to divide one of them into 2. But this may be one, maybe the most important one of all, and that the need for humility on the part of leadership. Verses 8 and 9. And no one has power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit. No one has power in the day of death. There is no release from that war, and wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. All this I have seen and applied my heart to every work that is done under the sun. There is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. And so the idea that he gets this from, great leaders will remain humble, is that great leaders recognize that there are certain things that no matter your authority, no matter your position, there are certain things that you cannot accomplish, certain things that you cannot change. And no one has the power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit. No one has the power over the days of death. Even the greatest men who have ever lived, whether it be military leaders, captains of industry, political leaders, men that we might hold in esteem, such as our fathers and our grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers, individuals who we consider as being great individuals, that doesn't change the fact that death is the end of all men. So there is that point that is made there. And I think it can scale out to other things as well, to recognize what it is that you can do and what it is that you can't. And so the idea is a person needs to not become arrogant and prideful in his approach to things, but realize his limits and retain his humility. That's, I think, an important point to be made, especially with regard to leadership in local congregation. The reference in James chapter 4 and verses 13 through 15 has to do with the arrogance of individuals who were determined to go and trade in the city and buy and sell for a year and make a profit. And this passage does not, of course, deny the legitimacy of making plans, but rather the arrogance of these individuals who thought that they had control of their lives and they could do as they wished without those limitations of life and the inevitability of death, because you don't know really what's going to happen, and you have to be understanding of that. And so whenever we find individuals in positions of leadership, it's always important that they be mindful of those things and remain humble. Your life is a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away.
I have a note in my Bible. I don't know if it's to that verse. It said it works both ways. The ruler himself, and though the person being ruled over, both of them humble himself.
Well, sure. There's that that responsibility. Again, he's emphasizing the leadership part, but Hebrews 13 clearly indicates the responsibility that we have to submit ourselves and to be obedient to those who have the rule or authority over us. And that takes humility. When you look at the, and I don't remember if it's in 2 Peter or Jude, the passages are so similar, but those false teachers at that time, one of the things that was characteristic of them is that they spoke evil of dignitaries, that they were disrespecting of authority. They railed against authority. They desired to be at liberty to do as they wished. And that was a characteristic of their carnality, carnal mindset. And so arrogance is always that. You can even see the example in the account Jesus gave of the Pharisee and the publican who both went to pray. The Pharisee lifted up his eyes to heaven, which was maybe... perhaps we don't understand that as much as it was in that culture, but that was a very arrogant thing to do. And in contrast to what the publican did, who prostrated himself on the ground and would not even look up, there is a difference in demeanor that's evident right there. But the thing that always is, to me, amazing is the difference in the spoken word, where the publican said, "God be merciful to me, a sinner." There's that acknowledgement of sin, and a recognition that I am dependent upon God's mercy to be forgiven. The Pharisee stood up and said, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men," and begins to talk about all of the things that he accomplished and did religiously. Well, that's arrogance. And that individual was not a submissive individual. It was one who sought self-exaltation. And that's unfortunately something that's characteristic with regard to leadership in every area. Is that you'll have individuals who desire authority and desire preeminence and attention, that they'll flock to those positions, they'll want those positions. And it's important, now again, it's inevitable that it's going to happen. You've got glory seekers in politics, you've got glory seekers in business, but it's incumbent upon Christians to ensure that we don't have glory seekers serving in leadership capacity in the church, because it's such a destructive thing, and its end is never good. So there is that idea that we need to be that we're humble, that we are aware of our limitations, that whenever there is something that comes up that where we don't know what to do, we need to be admitting of it and seeking counsel ourselves. Those are the kinds of characteristics that will make for a good leader rather than the other. There are two minor subpoints that are mentioned here under letter E, and that is that in the latter part of verse 8, wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. And so the idea is, as he applies it, because it is a very broad statement, but as he applies it, there are individuals who have the concept of might makes right. So I'm in a position... this is the way we're going to do it. Well, you shouldn't do it that way. Hey, we do it the way I want to do it. Yeah. I'm the leader, so we'll do it my way. And the idea that a person could have, that it may be wrong for others, or it may be inappropriate, but because I am in control, then that justifies the decision to do what I'm doing. That's something that's not true. The fact that I have the ability to do something does not mean that doing it is right. And a good leader is one who's always concerned with doing what is right. And so the compromise of God's laws and rules is never acceptable. And then the second paragraph, and I thought the entirety of that was pretty good, so I'll just read it to you. Some leaders love to exert their authority and push people around, and that individual may have the leader title, but no one is following. They're being pushed, they're not following. And a leader without follows is only taking a walk, a lonely walk, and eventually that becomes evident. Not always in the beginning, but eventually it does. And so those are some good points to be made. I think the last two points are probably the strongest of the five that are mentioned that are numbered as six in the book. Okay, anybody have any comments, questions about that section of the study? All right, the next section, which begins there in verse 10 and goes down through the end of the chapter, he puts under the heading unsolved mysteries, things that we cannot understand, no matter what our wisdom is. And the point that he wants to make in all of this is that whenever things happen that we do not understand, there is a tendency, because we have a difficult time understanding it, is to blame God. Because typically when we're talking about things we don't understand, it's things that are happening to us or our family or individuals that we know that seem to be wrong. There's just something not fair about those kinds of things. And we ask, why in the world could those things be? And if we can't work it out, then the scapegoat almost invariably becomes God in that regard. So he talks about this a little bit, and the idea, and I think the primary point to be made in all of this, is that we should trust God when those things happen that we cannot understand, to recognize that God knows what is best. And as we talked about, I think it was last Sunday morning in our sermon, ultimately the affairs of life that seem to be unfair, that we're perplexed at how things are going, that with that focus on eternity, that those things become easier to bear, because we know that ultimately God does settle accounts. Those accounts are settled in eternity. And that's something that is helpful to us, is in our mindset as we go through our lives. And so this is the point being made here in Ecclesiastes 8, 10, and following. Let's see, 15 through 17. Someone read 10 through 13 and the other person 14 through 17.
I'll start.
Okay.
10 through 14?
No, 10 through 13.
13. Then I saw the wicked buried who had come and gone from the place of holiness, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This also is vanity, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. Therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God.
Okay. Patsy, what do you mean?
There is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. So I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry, for this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life which God gives him under the sun. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, even though no one sees sleep day or night, then I saw all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it.
Well, the verses 16 and 17, I think, are the conclusion that we talked about I applied my heart to know wisdom, he said, and see all that's done on the earth. And I saw the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. So he came to the conclusion, trying to become knowledgeable and know all things, he understood that he could not. And no matter how you try, there are certain things that are just going to remain a mystery. And that gets us back to that point, that since the thoughts and ways of God, as Isaiah 55, are above our own, that his ways are not our ways, his thoughts not our thoughts, that it is incumbent upon us simply to trust him when things are not within our understanding in our interactions here on this earth. And so he gives some examples of this that are fairly interesting. And to be honest, in the reading of verse 10, it's a little bit difficult for me to know exactly. But I think he's got it right. He said, I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of holiness. So he's wicked. They were forgotten in the city where they had so done. And the idea is the wickedness that he did was forgotten in the city. And so here he is dead now. So what happens, and there's truth to this, what happens when someone, a wicked person, dies? He is preached into heaven, typically. That happens so often. Many of us have gone to funerals where an individual who is not spiritually minded at all, wasn't even a kind person, perhaps was not appreciative of his wife and children, not a good father, not a good husband, really just a person who had very little in the way of any redeemable qualities. But that's not the way he's remembered. You know, there may be an allusion to someone who's troubled or someone who may have struggled in their lives, but they had a good heart. And family, when they remember that, understandably, they want to remember the good times and forget the bad times as best they can. But it's very, very typical for corrupt individuals and wicked individuals to be eulogized and lionized in the eulogy whenever the funeral comes. And so he says that's vanity first, that it's uselessness, because preaching someone into heaven is not going to get him there, first point. But secondly, it's kind of an indication of how unfair life can be and how individuals can be with regard to their slant that they put on things. And I think that when you see that, that's just another example that makes it obvious that it is possible for individuals who do right, seek to live righteously, that they will suffer even in those efforts and those attempts, because the world is just a kind of a distorted and weird place. And it is perplexing how that might happen. So this is mystery. Why is that? Why do people, when a person dies, why do they not remember the dishonorable life that they lived? Why do people forget that? And some of these things, the idea, it's a mystery, it's imponderable. Solomon doesn't give us the answer as to why those things are, simply that they are so. Yes, Yo?
Sometimes the person has lived an honorable life, but still they're preaching heaven.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah. But that, and again, that's a typical practice. It's a little bit different from what we're talking about, but that's because honorable life is not a life that brings salvation. A forgiven life is the life that brings salvation. And being an honest person does not grant you standing in God's eyes because of the nature of sin. And that's something typical of the world. And to be honest, in funerals that I have preached, where you have an individual who was a good father and a good businessman or tried to do what was right, there have been a couple of occasions where it's obvious that his family adored him, that he had done right by them and those kinds of things, but he wasn't a Christian. And I don't think it's inappropriate to help them with their grieving by noting those positive aspects. But to say that because of those positive aspects that person's going to heaven, well, that's a step too far. And it's a hard thing to do, but to remain with integrity, you have to be careful in the way you put those things. But again, you know, that's that's because people just don't understand the nature of sin and how redemption comes. And no one understands that, or very few understand that at the time of their death of a loved one. Everybody wants to think that God is going to allow their individual to go to heaven because God is loving, and they weren't that bad. You know, and it just doesn't work that way. You know,
they say, well, it's my family. We're not perfect. Nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
They did so much good.
Yeah. There are all those excuses that are given. I remember going to a funeral. A local preacher, his son had become a drug addict, and though he had become a Christian, he was out of duty and had been for a long while, and not interested in antagonistic even to efforts to get him to come back. And he lost his life, and it was a very, very difficult thing for this man to do, but he stood up, and in the funeral where many of the young man's friends were, and said that he lost his way, and because of that, though he trusted in a merciful God, he couldn't say that he had hope for that person, for his son, because he had turned away from the Lord. And it was a means of saying, don't make the same mistake. And it was a very powerful message, and there are not very many people in the world, I think, who would be able to do that. And I don't know him very, very well, but he rose in my estimation a great deal with the courage that he showed in that particular time, because it was very, very deeply hurtful to him, and to remain so. But those kinds of things are again typical. We see it, and we sometimes have a hard time understanding how that could be. But with regard to wickedness and forgetting wickedness, verse 11 and 12 are also under this same category. And verse 11 talks about unfairness in the legal system. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. I think that is somewhat demonstrable in our society today. I'm not necessarily for a complete streamlining in the process. I mean, there is a reason why our defense system works it works the way it does, because there is an advocacy on the part of the accused that is needful for the innocent man. In other words, people can be accused wrongly, and so the presumption of innocence is something that is important, lest those who have done no wrong are accused falsely. But the procedures and the legal legalities and the extended appeal processes and how our justice system gears inexorably slowly, people just realize that there's no immediacy with regard to the punishment. And there might would be some of a deterrent effect if an individual knows that if I kill this person and caught, that within a week I'm going to be hanging on a tree or some other form of execution, there would be more likelihood that person wouldn't do it. And people say, no, the studies have been shown that the capital punishment has no deterrent effect. Well, there's two problems with that. Number one is it's not executed speedily. Never has been in America, at least not since the Wild West. And number two, there's not that acknowledgement that it deters that individual from doing wrong again, because that certainly serves as a deterrent. But whether it's a deterrent on others is in part mitigated because it just takes so long. A person will be 20, 25, 30 years in prison before he's executed as a result of some crime that he's done. And that makes no sense. And again, that's the execution, but it's also the execution of a sentence, not necessarily just the killing of a criminal. In other words, we're not just talking about capital punishment here, but certainly that would be involved in it. And that's unfair. You know, it's unfair to the victims of the crime. And so this is, of course, Solomon's wisdom, but it is inspired of God, and this is something to keep in mind. It's kind of when Christians argue against some of those things, wait a second, it's not just It's just not Solomon's opinion. This is what the Holy Spirit has to say on this particular matter. And that is an unfair aspect of our society as well, certainly. And then verse 12 explores the mystery of those who look like they got away with it. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before Him, but it will not be well with the wicked. Nor will he prolong his days, which are a shadow, because he does not fear before God. And so the point is, and this is the one that we make, and it's not always that it is settled here on earth, but most of the time it actually is. Because you think about those individuals, well, you know, he's getting rich. Well, why? Because he's breaking the law. And he's getting away with it. Yes, he's getting away with it, and he keeps doing it. So eventually he gets caught, goes to jail for it. So he's riding high on the hog for a while, but then he finally gets caught. And, well, you know, why are we suffering? And he's flying high with these unethical practices. Well, yeah, but just wait. And of course, ultimately, even if that doesn't come to pass, we trust in the fairness of God, because God is fair and God has revealed himself to be fair. So we know that ultimately he won't get away with it. And even if he gets away with it on earth, in eternity he doesn't. So even though men may not bring him to bear in judgment, God will. But it irks us. It upsets us in that regard. And I think that you can see that Solomon was a bit irritated about it as well. And again, he doesn't give in these particular mysteries here. He doesn't really give us, okay, this is the way to fix it. Because this is kind of the way the world works. And there is no real fix for it. But whenever we see that, we should not say, well, God's not fair. Which is the typical response in the world today. If God really existed, then all of this evil wouldn't be here. And they don't understand how things work. And if they did, then they wouldn't say that. All right, anything under letter A, mystery of forgotten wickedness. Okay, as a part of that then, there continues that thought that good things happen to bad people, bad things happen to good people in verse 14. Of the text, vanity which occurs, just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. And there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. And that basically indicates that you're doing everything right, but you still suffer. Or you're doing everything wrong, but you still are blessed. That doesn't make sense. And again, this can happen with regard to material things, but also we find individuals, let's just take as an example of someone who is accused unjustly for a crime he did not commit. So he goes to jail for a crime that didn't commit. Well, by extension, that means the one who did commit it got away with it. And why does that happen? It's just the unfairness of life. It's just one of those mysteries that crops up time and time again. And it's a shame. But we learn to trust the one who will eventually right every wrong. And I made that reference to 2 Thessalonians 1. It's kind of a go-to verse that I have when we talk about that. That at that time, the Macedonians were suffering persecution at the hands of others. And I like the phrase that it is a righteous thing with God. That because of God's righteousness, He will answer them by bringing judgment upon the disobedient and rest to those who are being persecuted. But, of course, the context of 2 Thessalonians 1 is that happens in the day of judgment, not during earth time, but at the end of time. It's when that will happen. So, something to keep in mind.
Well, we have to understand, too, that these people who are going to prison or wherever, and they're innocent, we're not God. You know, our minds don't work like His, and our systems aren't going to work accordingly. Much as they try sometimes, it just doesn't happen, and it's not necessarily anybody's fault, I don't guess, other than you don't have good enough lawyers or whatever.
Well, yeah, it's imperfection in man,
yeah,
sure. A limitation in our ability to perceive the truth.
It's really bad and shame when it happens.
And there's sometimes his fault. There is corruption that exists, mm-hmm. And that's the case. But But again, you take as an example, and it's kind of an absurd one, I guess, because it doesn't happen as much as what the TV shows would have you believe. But when someone is framed for a crime they didn't commit, in other words, someone plants evidence. They want to put suspicion on someone else. If they do a good job of it, well, you know, it's going to be hard to direct the suspicion elsewhere. That's not a matter of the detective being incapable or corrupt, or the judge or the jury. It's simply a matter of someone did a good job of being deceitful. Lies work. That's why people lie, because they're effective. And now they have consequences, and ultimately lie upon lie upon lie is found out. And you know, we tell, you know, children don't lie because you'll be found out. And most of the time that's the case. But I think all of us can think of times in our childhood to where we got away with something, you know, and parents didn't find out. And the reason for that is because you don't always, you are not always discovered with regard to your lies and deceits. And
I think those things are bothered God. All your life. You're bothered when you remember. I guess we all have one, but I think one that just, I can't believe it did that.
Yeah, I got you.
You know,
I know what you mean.
We all have that.
Yeah. Those things happen,
and you forget them,
and you get away with it, but they come with a price too, but certainly you don't get
that's
away with
teach
it.
You a little bit too.
You don't get away with it in God's eyes, which means that's why it's important that you repent of all your sins. Lay your soul open to the Lord. Okay, then the final point here on page 39, and that is the mystery of simple pleasures. And perhaps not worded as a mystery in this particular text, but a response to the mystery of good things happening to bad, bad things happening to good. So what basically Solomon says, it's hard to understand why, or I cannot understand the vanity of good things happening to bad people and bad things happening to good people. So, this is what I decided to do. I committed enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. So what it does say is, you know, a lot of wickedness, there's a lot of evil, there's a lot of unfairness in the world, but there are certain things that happen in your life that you can take solace in and enjoy, and with regard to your possessions, with regard to the simple pleasures of life, and that's what he specifically refers to as the simple pleasures of life. That joy comes from that, so enjoy. Okay, so that's not an illegitimate sentiment; it's an appropriate sentiment, especially in the context. But it's interesting that the phrase "eat, drink, and be merry" was used in the New Testament with a very different context. Wasn't it? With regard to the rich man who fared sumptuously, and he was so successful that he determined to tear down his barns and build greater to hold all his possessions. And he said the same thing: eat, drink, and be merry. And he was called a fool. So the wise man says here, eat, drink, and be merry. The rich man was called a fool for doing just that. So I think it's important that we acknowledge that and understand what is the distinction or difference. And what is being said, and it might be an important point to be made, because in Ecclesiastes and Proverbs and other places in this wisdom literature, especially in Ecclesiastes, when he talks about all is vanity and there's no worth in life lived under the sun, is that there might be that very fatalistic viewpoint to indicate that we shouldn't enjoy ourselves, or there is no enjoyment. We're going to be miserable as long as we live on this earth. There's nothing we can do about it. So let's just steel ourselves to this misery until we die, and then we'll be happy. And that's not so. And I think that anecdotally we can see that in our own lives. Even if we're at a stage in our life where there is some trial, there are many happy times that we had in our lives, our families, and the simple pleasures of life as mentioned here that we've enjoyed. So those things have value if it's not lived under the sun. If what we have done is taking care of business first and being acceptable to God and reconciled to Him, then it's right and proper for us to enjoy ourselves. I mean, when I think of simple pleasures, the two things that come to my mind with regard to my life as far as a simple pleasure, number two is golf, but number one is playing with my grandkids. So, you know, just the joy, you know, if I've had a bad day, if I get to see my grandkids, then that kind of melts away. Being able to go with Josh and get out and spend 3.5-4 hours and away from stress and just hit a little, wow, that's ridiculous. It's an absurd game to play. And it can be infuriating from time to time, too, when you don't play it well. But it's a stress relief, and it's something that I enjoy, being with him. So those are two just simple things. My relationship with my wife is not simple. That's why I didn't put it in there. It's a pleasure, but not simple.
Likewise.
So, but those two things, and it's just the nice things in life. Now, if I were to say, forget God, not interested in spiritual matters, this is what I want to do. I want to golf on Sunday, and all that matters is my family and my pastimes, and I'm not interested in things of God, then I'm foolish. So there's the difference between the two. And so this is in no way setting aside the importance of serving God first, but just to recognize that as we serve God first, that there is plenty of time in our lives, and God expects us. He wants us to enjoy ourselves as we live on this earth, and there is much good to be found in the lives that we have. And so this is, I don't necessarily think it's a mystery per se, but he says we have two options. Because we are struggling with these things we don't understand, we can become bitter and decide God can't be trusted, or we can go about our business and live in appreciation of our blessings. And he gives a couple of examples. Job expressed thankfulness to God despite the suffering that he experienced at his hand. Joseph was appreciative to God even though he had been sold into slavery and ended up in prison in Egypt. And when we think about those things, can see how if someone has that perception. Of course, we're studying on Sunday morning Philippians, and the Apostle Paul is very much mindful of that. In Philippians 4:4, I think, is the text where he says, rejoice. And again, I say rejoice. Or always rejoice. I think exactly the... I'm reading it last night and just kind of goes out of my mind for some reason. But that call for us to rejoice in the midst of difficulties is something that he personified in his life. And rejoice in the Lord always. Always, that's the phrase. Yeah. Again, I say rejoice. So, you know, in that recognition that he can have joy even when imprisoned, it serves as a good example for us. And I guess the way we could say even in the simple things, what made Paul happy while he was imprisoned? So he was under house arrest, and so he was limited. He wasn't sure if he was going to live or be executed for what was not a crime, so it would be an unjust sentence. But Epaphroditus came and brought gifts from the Philippians. And he was reminded of the joy that he had. He heard reports of the fact that there were individuals who were emboldened by his chains to preach the gospel. And that made him happy as well. And so those are things that are outside of his own circumstances, but he could look to it and could rejoice as a result of. And I think it serves as a good example for us. All right. Questions, comments about that little section? That gets us then to the bottom of the page, which says verses 16 and 17 reminds us that there are some things we will never know, some questions that we will never have answered, which we allude to at the beginning of this particular section. And so we must walk by faith and not by sight, which is the only way to really live. So that's kind of a concluding statement concerning that section. There are certain things that the wise man will not understand and cannot find out, though he labors to do so. All right, then let us, in the last 10 minutes that we have or so in our class, just go over the discussion questions, and perhaps we'll be able to get into chapter 9 next week. You know, one of the things with regard to the discussion questions, a few of them are good in eliciting discussion and deeper understanding, but some of them are just restatements of what we've already mentioned and discussed. So what is said, it's said that everything rises or falls on leadership. What happens in companies when leaders are indecisive, unclear, or have no vision?
follow if you don't know where you're going.
Okay.
And they lose their business.
Yeah, that's a failure or stagnation. The business doesn't prosper. And of course, the further follow-up of that question is, does the same principle apply in the family or in the local church? Which is kind of to ask it is to answer it. We all recognize that case. So the same kinds of problems, failure, stagnation, loss of morale, all of those things can happen if there is not the proper leadership and vision with leadership. Okay, question number two, according to the end of verse 1, which says, man's wisdom makes his face shine and the sternness of his face is changed. Again, the word sternness means the strength of his face. So his face is softened. Then, what should characterize God's leader?
Wisdom.
Certainly. That's not the point that he made, primary point that he made in his book, in the booklet, though. The wisdom causes what in the leader? What does wisdom lead to?
Arrogance.
According to that verse.
Makes his face shine.
He makes his face shine and his the hardness of his face is changed. So, in other words, a wise man is going to be approachable, going to be gentle, going to be kind, because that's what the wise way of approaching people. That's where I said, could be somewhat superficial in the idea that, to be a servant and elder in the church, you always have to be smiling. That's not what's being said. This is why I mentioned in our study last week, as we dealt with these particular issues, mentioned Brother Foster as a good example of a sober-minded man. He was quiet, but he was kind, and he was approachable, and individuals loved him because of who he was and what he stood for. So it's not a superficial thing. That's what I wanted to stay away from, is that kind of that idea. And I don't think he really did a good job of that in the book, but it's a legitimate point to be made that an austere, domineering, which, by the way, the Apostle Peter warns again in 1 Peter 5 when he said not to lord it over the flock, but that austere, demanding, unapproachable individual who is stern and dismissive and those kinds of things, who has that arrogance and that we talked about, that person is not going to be a good leader. And needs to be different.
Instead of sternness, it's got a side note here. It says, gives the word strength of his face.
Yeah, the strength. And again, but the strength of his face has changed. So it's one of the things that you can, when I'm angry, you can kind of tell because I clench my jaw. And so you see these kind of, not so much anymore that I've gained weight, but but you can see the muscles working and that kind of thing. And so, but that kind of expressions of disapproval and sternness and clenching, that kind of stuff, that a softening of a face, his strength changes. It becomes less strong and more soft. Again, not strong and weak, but clenched and unclenched, put it that way. So it's a matter of the demeanor. That's what's under consideration here. It's personified by the face, but it has to do with
the demeanor. We've all seen it or done it.
Do what?
We've all seen it or done it, one of the two.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody
has
that.
Yeah, sure.
It's kind of a telltale, too, if members go to the preacher first before they go to the elders.
Yeah, there are two reasons for that. One time is if an elder is or a group of elders are not approachable and the preacher is. The second, actually there can be three reasons for it. The second is the denominational concept. When you have individuals who may have come out of the denominations, and that we teach all the time, the preacher is not the pastor. There is sometimes that kind of a feeling on the part of some to where it's a natural inclination to go to him first, because that's what they did when they were younger or whatever. And then the third thing is it's simply a matter of visibility, I think, that they're more comfortable perhaps because they feel they know the preacher because he's the one that's always in front of them, whereas sometimes the elders are not. So But again,
isn't that their job to get in front of?
Well, that's that's the point. And so how would wisdom alleviate that kind of problem? Well, there are two things. First of all, the preacher will say, "Don't go to me, go to the elders," which I've done many times, and every preacher does. But the other thing would be that the elders make that effort to be known by the members and to be central, and that's an important consideration. Yeah, true. I mean that's something that's just an obvious thing, and I think something here, you know, there are many individuals that if an elder is approachable, or he may consider himself approachable, but nobody approaches him. Well, you know, number one, that may be an indication maybe you're not as approachable as you think you are, but more probably the people aren't aware, and the way in which that's done is the elder goes to the people. You know, in other words, you develop a relationship. It's not a passive thing; it's an active thing on the part of leadership. But I think it's something we understand. You can't lead from behind in the sense not being central and vital to the relationships we sustain. That's true with regard to, you know, say a children with a parent, you know, father, say, well, you know, he wasn't approachable. And father might say, well, there's not a single time when they came to me that I didn't accept what, you know, that I didn't, yeah, but he didn't make the effort. And that's important. All right. Continuing on then. Question number three. Thinking of the example of Jesus, what makes a leader approachable versus unapproachable? So there, maybe that's what we're talking about a little bit. Because I put in effort as part of it.
And Jesus was there. He was doing with them, beside them. He wasn't, this is what you do. You know, he was actively showing them and being a part of everything he...
The example of washing their feet.
Exactly.
For example, those kinds of leading by example. The thing that stands out to me about Jesus, perhaps more than any other, is the compassion that he showed. And that compassion was not always evident, because there were evil individuals who were seeking to do him harm, and he did respond appropriately in those kinds with sternness and even physical action. But the common people who were hurting, he didn't wait on them. He went to them, and I you know, so many times I think about that. But one example that stands out in my mind, we've studied it recently, is the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4. And you think he had been walking, he was thirsty, he was tired, his disciples had gone to get something to eat, and he was just sitting to rest by the well. And the woman comes along, and he asks her for a drink, and it could have stopped there. You know, either she refused him, why are you asking me a drink? You're a Jew. You know, there was that. Well, it was a teaching opportunity. And because he was compassionate with regard to his response to her, instead of dismissive like any other Jewish male would have been, he not only brought her to faith, but all of her countrymen as well. And it's an amazing thing to see when you see that kind of example. And you think about the way all of us can be, and this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with leadership, but how easy it is for us when we are interacting with individuals that we may not know well, when there is an opportunity for us simply to say a kind word or maybe make a spiritual point or invite them to worship or something like that, but it's just too much trouble because all we want is our coffee from Starbucks or our soft drink or whatever the case, and they go on. You know, we maybe are not as mindful of those kinds of things to actually make the effort. And I think Jesus certainly always did that. So yeah, he was, if we want a personification of good leadership, then we've got it in Jesus for sure. All right, question number four, what is Solomon's point about leadership in the 8th verse? Where it says, no one has the power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit. No one has the power in the day of death. There is no release from that war, and the wickedness will not remember those who are given to it. What's the point being made there? In our discussion.
Leading with humility.
Yeah. To know what you don't know and know what you can't do and be humble. Humility is and of course that's in a demonstration of that. You need to recognize that there are things that you can't change. It takes humility to do that. That's important.
There's a poem, I'm sure we've all heard it. I ran across it as a teenager, and it's just always stuck with me. The Serenity Prayer. God, give me the strength to change the things I can change.
The patience to understanding to know what I can't change and the wisdom know the difference.
Yes, something like that.
Or meekness to accept what I can't change. I forget how exactly it is, but yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that. Okay, then let us, we're just out of time, so I'm going to, 5 through 9, I'm going to read what I got, and we can open it up. I just, you know, we can start here, but I'd like to start on new material. Anything more tragic than leaders who think they're leading it, no one is following? What eventually happens when they lose the respect of the people? They lose their ability to lead. There's no one left to lead if that happens, is the point that he made in the lesson. 6, why do bad things happen to good people? And that's a mystery that we don't know, other than people aren't perfect, and so those things can happen. But the emphasis was that accounts are not settled here, and we need to recognize that.
Rain falls on the just and the unjust.
It's just that, you know, as a matter of God's will, that ties in with the concept of the free will of man. God's will. God intended for men to make decisions for themselves. And if that's going to be, and that's a wonderful blessing, it comes with the repercussions of people choosing to do evil, which causes suffering. So that happens. So we're living in a fallen world in that regard. 11, that is, the sentence not executed. Is that happening today? Well, we've already talked about that. Of course it is. 8, there are some spiritual songs we sing louder than others. I know that my Redeemer lives. Well, that's taken from Job, the 19th chapter in verse 25, which indicates that he wasn't in a high point when he said that, but rather a low point, in the deepest valley of pain and suffering. But the point is that even in the midst of that, he decided to serve God and to trust in his Redeemer. And that's a good lesson for us as well. If they can do that, then we can do that as well. So the question was, how does their example of faith encourage, how does it encourage us? By helping us to realize that no matter how difficult our life can be, or might be, that we can serve the Lord acceptably and have joy in that. My lesson on Sunday morning is entitled Rejoice. I've written an article, and I want to preach that article on Sunday morning. And it's just amazing how often the call is given, such as in Philippians 4, to rejoice in the Lord always. That need to rejoice is something that's important. And then finally, 9, according to verse 17, will man eventually discover everything? And he says, even the wise men, though they seek it, they will not. So mysteries of life are going to continue. And they'll be continuing long after we're dead. And they'll be continuing until the Lord comes again. You can't control it. You can't know it. So enjoy yourself on earth and be prepared for eternity. And that's, I think, the important lesson.
If it wasn't for the bad times we have, we wouldn't really realize how good the good times are. You know, you just couldn't.
What is today?
Saturday.
So when is my date says the 4th for some reason. I don't know.
That was Sunday.
Yeah, I know.
You didn't adjust after the short February.
Yeah, I guess that's part of it, the 3 days. Well, yeah, because it's 3rd, 28th, and 31. That's right. I forget. I get one of these analog clocks, you got to make that change. All right. What's going on here? Okay, so then, well, on the 3:14 then, we will pick up with lesson 9.